Welcome to Potter Revisited, episode 66. I'm Tori.
And I'm Shay.
Today we are covering chapter 6 of Goblet of Fire, The Portkey.
Or, as we like to call it,
Nauseating Wizard Travel.
So up front, as a Harry Potter podcast, I feel obliged to touch on some of the things the author has been saying again. And they are, as expected, not good, deeply offensive, and hurtful and beneficial to no one. So, the author is once again using her platform, which she built by writing a young adult novel about friendship and magic, to actively hurt a marginalized community. She's once again going out of her way to disrespect and hurt the trans community. It's cruel, and there is no justification for her actions. At Potter Revisited, we believe that trans lives matter. Trans men are men. Trans women are women. And thus they are impacted by women's issues. The author's continued attempts to justify the exclusion of trans people under the guise of feminism is deeply offensive and hurtful. There is not a limited number of seats at the table of womanhood. The inclusion of trans women does not result in the exclusion of cisgender women.
I would like to highlight two organizations. The Trevor Project and Trans Lifeline both provide excellent services and resources for the trans community. If anyone would like to learn more about those services, I will have them linked below in the show notes. We open up chapter 6 with everyone kind of getting woken up by Mrs. Weasley to prepare to get ready to leave for the World Cup.
The energy of this chapter is like very, very similar to like waking up early to catch a flight. To go on a trip, like you're tired, you're sleepy, you're drowsy, you're a little grumpy, but you're excited, like underneath all of that, you're just not awake enough to experience the excitement.
Yeah.
And that's very much how the time at the Weasleys feels in this chapter. We also get another fun Britishism, which is Mr. Weasley putting treacle?
I think it's treacle.
Treacle on his breakfast. And I had to Google it because I know there's treacle tarts. They've been discussed earlier.
Yes, that's Harry's favorite.
But I need to understand what it was because I realized not a clue. So it's apparently an uncrystallized syrup made during the refining of sugar. The most common forms of treacle are golden syrup, a pale variety, and a black treacle, a darker variety similar to molasses. So it's syrup.
I always thought treacle was kind of like a mix between maple syrup and like honey, is always what I imagined.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that, of course, was it Bill, Charlie, and Percy aren't leaving with most of the week, Mr. Weasley and the kids, because they can apparate, so they're just going to apparate over later. It's like lie in, and Fred's kind of peeved off about this, because I know like when you have to get up early and your siblings don't, it is not fair.
It's the worst.
And Fred talks about like how like, oh, we could just apparate, and they're like, oh, you don't have your license. So like, does Fred know how to apparate, or is he just referencing that maybe they could do side-along apparation?
Yeah, because they say you don't have your license, but a side-along apparation is legal for like the passenger to not have a license, then to me, bringing up him not having a license isn't a valid excuse. I think he's implying that he just, I mean, I'm sure Fred thinks he can apparate. It wouldn't surprise me if he'd been like secretly teaching himself to apparate somehow because he's the type.
I'm assuming he has like enough like older brothers and stuff that he probably knows more about apparition than like Harry or Hermione would at this point, because they're not really taught, I don't think, until like sixth year when they would be taking the test if they were old enough. But I'm assuming that some people would know.
And I feel like 50% of apparition isn't like the skill or like the studying. It's just like having the willpower to know you're going to succeed when you try. And I feel like Fred and George definitely have that sort of level of confidence that I think like, I wouldn't be surprised if they did well on their first apparition tests, because of course it's so them to be able to be good at the thing that allows mischief to be easier.
Well, in the next book, they like apparate everywhere in the next book. So
yeah,
Mr. Weasley kind of segues this and he talks about like you had to have your license because there is like there's splinching, which is when you apparate and you leave part of yourself behind, which sounds terrifying, awful, and we obviously know later in Deathly Hallows it happens to Ron, but I'm like, well,
foreshadowing, splinching is a bad time. I feel like I picture, like, as, like, a fan of, like, horror cinema and, like, someone who loves, like, Guillermo del Toro and, like, early George A. Romero films, I picture it a lot gorier than they let it be in a children's movie. So when I picture splinching, it's horrific.
Well, I think originally when they had, Ron's splinching scene, I think the trailer had it pretty gory, and I think in the actual movie they took a lot of like the blood and out because they were still trying to keep that PG-13 rating. But ideally, it would be really awful.
In my mind, it's horrendously graphic and painful, and like, so just thinking about it, I'm like, yikes.
So they're eating their breakfast and they're getting ready to go, and George and Fred have tried to slip out of the house all their Tun Tong toffees under Mrs. Weasley's nose, and obviously she catches them. And I just wonder, like, should they have been smarter about how they were smuggling the toffees out?
They totally should have. First of all, I would like to compliment you on saying its name properly.
Yeah, I know.
Did you practice? It took a lot of practice. It's tough. I think they should have been more clever. I think just putting it in their pockets was dumb and lazy, and I think if they were smart...
Well, they were trying to hide them, but I just think taking all of them out at once was a risk.
Yeah, I think they would have, knowing how Miss Weasley felt about it and knowing she wanted them destroyed, gone out into the yard or, like, nearby the house somewhere in just a field a while ago and, like, buried a stash, and then they can go back and pick it up between leaving their house and going to the Quidditch World Cup or wherever else they want to take it. I feel like a farther away from Miss Weasley's stash is the only way you're going to be able to sneak around like that now that she's caught on to their shenanigans.
Yeah, because they were hiding them, obviously, because they knew. But it was funny because, like, they had, like, they were in, like, the lining of one of their coats and in, like, the upturn of, like, their pants and stuff. So they obviously were, like, trying their best to hide them. But I just feel like taking them all out at, like, the one time was, like, a risk because, obviously, Mrs. Weasley has had, like, what, 7 kids? So she can, like, kind of, like, smell kind of mischief. Obviously, there's a scene where Mrs. Weasley summons all the toffees, and there's a lot of friction between the twins and their mom right now because they're yelling at her, like, you know, they spent 6 months just developing these sweets, and it's like they put, like, all, like, their ambition and, like, their time into it, and she's just like, oh, like, this is why you didn't get good marks on your exams, and kind of just like bring back up that idea that, like, she thinks they don't have ambition and then they're not doing anything, like, worthwhile with, like, their life, and, like, to them this is what they want to do. It's just like they don't really understand each other at this point. So the twins don't even say goodbye to their mom. They just walk out of the house. They're like, yeah, we're done.
It's kind of funny because I feel like an interesting comparison to what Fred and George go with career-wise is kind of like how people who have become legitimate, well-paid people based on, like, internet careers, like YouTubers, people who live stream games, or even podcasters, not us,
yeah,
who make enough money to make a living off of this. I feel like when they were younger and they were in high school and they started doing this, their parents said, stop video gaming, stop doing your makeup on the internet, stop talking about murder to strangers on the internet, and do your homework. That's what's going to get you far. And it's interesting that there's people who their side project hobby legitimately became their career, and it's now being seen as, like, a valid career that you can do for a long time and make very good money doing. In many circles, it's seen as a very respectable, like, career. It's something people look up to and admire. So it's interesting that, like, it's sort of that same vibe for the twins, where it's their side project, their side hustle, their hobby, and no one can see the value in it because it hasn't really made a lot of money yet or been, like, positively taken in by, like, customers or society yet. But, like, once the twins get a shop and people start spending money there, I feel like Molly flips her tune pretty quickly.
Half-Blood Prince, she's like, oh, wow, they're doing so well. Everything's so great. I love this career for my kids.
I've always supported my sons and their desire to have a joke shop. I have always.
So this is kind of a transitional chapter. So they end up walking to Portkey Point, and Mr. Weasley does a lot of explaining about how Portkeys work to Harry, which I think is interesting because Portkeys become a big part of this book. And he even tells Harry, like, oh, they can be anything. Anything you want.
Very, very handy. Very nice job, Mr. Weasley. As always, truly contributing.
And we meet at the top of the hill, Cedric Diggory back again, and his dad.
Amos. Amos is the most annoying man. He's just...
Yeah, Amos reminds me of those dads that just live vicariously through their kids, especially, like, just sport dads.
Sport dads. Yep. This is my son. He's only 7, but he's going to make the NHL. He's the next Sidney Crosby. He's going to score golden goals. I can't wait. He's going to be given exceptional status and allowed to play junior early. I can tell already. And the kid's, like, 7 and, like, still pushing a chair and, like, at Little League's junior skating lessons. And you're like, okay.
especially compared to how just Cedric is to his dad. Like, his dad's just boasting about him and stuff. And Cedric, we know him to be, like, from at least Prisoner of Azkaban. Like, we don't know much about him, but we know that he values, like, fairness and sportsmanship. And he's just, like, you know, he's a Hufflepuff, so he's loyal and just, like, hardworking and everything. And he doesn't want his... He's like, Dad, stop. Like, stop embarrassing me.
Especially because Cedric doesn't see his win over Harry in that Quidditch game as a win because there were extenuating circumstances that were not caused by either of the teams.
It wasn't fair,
Like, from a sports side. So, like, he's probably... A, embarrassed that that's how he won the game because it doesn't feel clean to him. And also he's embarrassed that his dad doesn't realize that. Like, I don't think Amos was a Hufflepuff. I'm not saying he was a Gryffindor, but I think he was a Gryffindor. I feel like, at most, what Amos could say is that, based on a Quidditch game's results, maybe his son is a better flyer than Harry based on the fact that his son stayed on the broom and Harry didn't. But you absolutely cannot say the better man won when you're talking about Harry Potter, who had beaten Voldemort multiple times while still being a child, versus your son, who has saved nobody's life, has not saved the school, just minding his own business playing sports. And you're like, definitely the better man, because that one time he beat Harry Potter at a sport.
I feel like the way that's written, it's how being, like, masculine means being good, being athletic and being, like, the best player on the team. So, like, the better man all around is, like, the man that's, like, the most masculine and macho and the best at the sport and everything.
Yeah. It's a skewed view of masculinity where it's sport is the, like, primary aspect in which you can value one's quality as a person, which is just not true. You can be incredibly good at a sport and a horrible person, or be really bad at sports and a wonderful person.
I did think it was sad looking back, because Amos talks about Cedric's win, in quotations, against Harry, and how it would be something to tell his grandkids in the future, and obviously that doesn't happen.
Oh. No grandkids. Sorry, Amos. And I'm sure Harry's not telling his grandkids, this one time I beat Cedric Diggory at Quidditch. Okay, I didn't. But it's not my fault I lost.
I mean, the cursed play did have a lot of weird Amos.
We don't talk about It That Shall Not Be Named. Firstly, because I haven't read it and I won't. But also just because, ew, gross.
They bring back Cedric in it to just besmirch his character and it's no good.
Oh god, I don't want to know, Tori. Stop telling me. Just stop telling me things I don't want to know.
But you need to suffer along with me.
Ugh, no thank you. I've opted out. So I find it interesting that in this chapter, my sort of view of Cedric transitions very quickly. Like, when they first introduced him in this chapter, they're like, this is Cedric. Remember, he's that Hufflepuff Quidditch guy who beat Harry. And you're like, okay, so we a little bit don't like him because he beat Harry, but in like a high school level of don't like. And they're like, also, he's very handsome. And I'm like, oh, so we really don't like Cedric because he's handsome and he's good at sports. So like they've archetyped him into this like popular, good looking, good at sports, all around great guy. I'm like, okay, so we're not supposed to like Cedric. We're supposed to a little bit be like, oh, him again. But then really, really quickly, I find my view transitioned. And I sort of feel like, oh, his dad is exhausting. And he himself, Cedric, is very polite. He seems empathetic. He seems fair. So I've gone from being like, oh, I kind of resent this guy for being everything you could ever want a guy to be. How dare he? And now I just feel bad for him. I'm like, he's a nice, sweet guy. And he has to be put in these uncomfortable situations.
Yeah.
That he doesn't deserve to be in, and it's not his fault he's handsome and good at Quidditch, I guess. Like, how dare I have judged him so quickly?
Yeah, Cedric's, like, an interesting character, because obviously it's so heartbreaking because he's just kind of, like, innocent everything. He's just this nice guy. And it's also interesting because Harry gets really jealous of him because he just has things that Harry wants. And we're like, we don't like Cedric because we want Harry to get, like, the things he wants because he's our guy. But it's also, like, Cedric is just, you know, he's just living his life. He didn't ask for anything.
Yeah, seriously. He's just a perfectly happy, minding his own business, non-offensive side character.
I think it's just a very teenage experience where, like, there's just people that you have no beef with, but they're just, like, it's just, like, kind of envy and jealousy that you have to deal with, being like, well, there's no reason for you to not like them because they haven't done anything to, like, personally, like, wrong you, but it's just them existing is, like, ruins your life.
I think it has a lot to do with stereotyping of characters in media we consumed when we were young. So, like, this doesn't do it because Cedric ends up being a good guy. But in a lot of shows and movies, growing up when you're our age, like, preteen and childhood content we viewed was very, like, the pretty popular people are mean. And they bully the weird, unique, different kids, and that's the norm. So you start to think, okay, if someone seems popular and is attractive or described as conventionally attractive, they're not going to be nice.
Yeah, they're just vapid.
Yeah, exactly. Unless it's like the main character is a nerdy guy and the attractive popular person is a pretty girl. Sometimes he gets her in the end. But it's very much like a set of traits that are so often combined that we're predisposed to be like, oh, he can't be nice because he's popular and good looking and people are mean when they have those traits in comparison. Like,
well, those were very ingrained into us growing up in like every form of media.
Absolutely.
I do like the offhand mention before they obviously take the portkey is that they're mentioning other families that live in the area, and Amos mentions the Lovegoods. So a little hint of Luna before we actually meet her next book.
Can we talk about how terrible a name that is, Lovegood? It sounds like a bad, raunchy rom-com name. Like, not like a weird, whimsical, fantastical, slightly off-kilter weirdo, you know? Such a weird choice of name. I mean, I guess the author knew the name Luna because Luna sounds like the perfect name for the character and then just wanted the alliteration. But, like, there's other L-less names.
You have issues with, like, every name in this book.
Listen.
Bertha Jorkins. Lovegood.
Bertha Jorkins is bad. Lovegood is cheesy. Bertha Jorkins is bad, but maybe intentionally bad to be remembered because it's important, kind of. But maybe I'm very critical. I'm a bit of a hater. I hate. Haters gonna hate.
Well, that's the reason for rereading the series and doing the podcast is we want to look at things as adults and read through and be like, you know what? This is kind of shit. This was, you know, yeah, I see this differently now.
Come here for deep, intense, intellectual conversations such as, I don't like the name Lovegood.
And you know, stuff like this.
We've really grown into eloquently thought out connoisseurs of book reviews.
I mean, our general way to go is we blame Dumbledore for everything.
Yeah, how is Luna Lovegood's last name being Lovegood Dumbledore's fault?
Dumbledore's fault. Everything's Dumbledore's fault. We are the Dumbledore Hate Podcast. It's kind of the end of the chapter. It's more of a transitional chapter getting us from the Burrow to where we're going to be at the World Cup. But we get a lot of new transportation methods in this book alone compared to book two, I think, was the one we got a bunch of new transportation methods. So we get
quite a few new transportation methods of the wizard community in this book, two of which are just in this chapter. The first one being apparition. So we learn about splinching, we get a bit of a foreshadow. It's really our first real introduction to apparition as like a concept.
Yeah, it's been talked about, but we get a lot more information about it. Like, you had to have a license and what things can happen to you if it goes wrong.
You have a certain age.
Yes.
It's very getting your driver's license. You know, you have to take the course, you have to pass the test, you have to be this old. I have so many more questions about apparition, though. Like, how far is it safe to apparate? You know what I mean? Because, like, we know you can apparate, like, oh, I'm at home, I'll apparate to the grocery store or whatever. That seems like a sensible apparation. But, like, what if you're in New Brunswick and you want to apparate to Vancouver? That's all the way across Canada for everyone else.
I feel like because Europe's so, like, small compared to like Air America and Canada here, and like everything's so close together, where like we're huge bodies of land,
we're very spread out.
So but I feel like there must be a certain amount of difference where like it's too far, which I feel like apparition takes like energy out of you because you have to like concentrate so much. So I feel like a certain distance might be a bit risky. You're more likely to splint yourself, so I feel like it wouldn't be suggested.
Like, we know Dumbledore can sidelong apparate with, like, bringing Harry with him to, like, the coast from where Hogwarts is, presumably in, like, the middle of Scotland. So that's a bit of a distance with sidelong apparition. And he seemed, like, canonically, like, it didn't wipe him out, but I'm sure it had a bit of a physical response. But then my other question is, because Europe is so close together and all the countries are very nearby, how does international travel work? When you cross an international border via apparition, is there like a customs office? Like, if you are apparating to Wales, you have to operate to this particular place in Wales where there will be a custom agent who will stamp your passport or make sure you're not bringing in illegally thin cauldrons.
I feel like there has to be certain like places that you have to operate to come into the country so they can kind of check you out and everything.
But then also how hard would it be to put in those protections, right? Because we know like Hogwarts, you can't operate inside Hogwarts. That seems like pretty advanced magic. They put that curse over just Hogwarts property so people can't operate in and out. But does that mean, like, countries have to have that over their country with one little opening only in the operation sphere of protection? Like, how do you manage protecting all the other areas of your country from having people randomly internationally travel there? You'd have to have some sort of protection against it that sort of, like, forces would be international crime people into, like, operating to the right spot, you would think. But it's very, like, I want to know. I'm very curious how that would work. Like, what protections are in place to ensure that you know where wizards are and if people are visiting or if someone's gone missing where they were last seen? How do you know Jorkins was in Albania or whatever, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You gotta sign the guest book or something when you operate in. And also, I wonder if operating further distances takes longer time. Like, I wonder if, like, me operating from my bedroom to my kitchen is like the snap of the fingers, but me operating from my bedroom to the grocery store is like a 5-minute operation. Like, does it take a proportionate amount of time to the amount of time it would take to travel there by foot or by car?
Yeah, it'd also be interesting to think about if you go from one place to another, but the time difference, like how that would affect it.
I mean, I'm assuming it's like travel where you'd have a bit of like, it would feel weird because it still feels like 3 p.m. for you, but it's actually 4 p.m. or a slightly larger distance than that, I guess, if you're going to Australia. But I feel like you wouldn't miss days of travel while you're disapparating. Like, I don't think anyone is strong enough or has enough energy to apparate a distance that would take, like, an overnight flight of, like, 12 to 14 hours. I feel like you don't have enough energy. Like, you can't be awake that long, so you can't consciously apparate that long. So you'd have to do, like, a hop-along. Like, I'll apparate from Montreal to Prince Edward Island because it's closer to the ocean on that side. And then I'll hop over to Europe and then I'll hop over to wherever I'm going, Finland. I don't know. But I feel like there's more to apparition that I want to understand before I can fully embrace it as a legitimate magical transit method, because no one would allow it to exist if it couldn't be governed in some way. It's regulated, so it's governed.
You'd hope so, but I mean, the Ministry of Magic's kind of chaotic, and it feels very much like...
Yeah. I mean, that's the British one, though, right? We don't know. Maybe, like, the Polish Ministry of Magic has all their shit together.
We also got the Portkey introduced this chapter, obviously.
Yeah, the other transportation method that we get this chapter.
And this seemed more regulated.
Yeah, this seems a lot more regulated, at least in the context of the Quidditch World Cup. Like, they say the ministry organizes it, so that makes sense because the ministry is sort of overseeing the event. But I wonder if, like, any reasonably powerful wizard could set up a portkey.
Well, we know Dumbledore sets up portkeys and stuff, and...
But you know Dumbledore. He does whatever he wants. He breaks the rules, and he has an abundance of magic. So I wonder if, like, Remus Lupin could make a portkey, you know? And I wonder, like, how they keep track.
I feel like they say later that portkeys are supposed to be regulated by, like, the Ministry of Transportation or something. So if you want to set up a portkey, you have to get, like, permission or whatever. And so they know, like, where it's going and what time it's going at. But I feel like Dumbledore just does stuff.
Okay, but if you're a good guy, but if you're, like, a bad guy, yeah. If you're a villain using one, you're not going to tell the government you're going to use one. And if you're a good guy who's on the run, Sirius Black, for example... good guy, loosely on the side of the good guys, and you want to set one up and you're on the run, you'd still have to do it illegally.
Yeah.
It just seems like all of these, it seems very hard to regulate the wizarding transportation in any way. Not that I don't love a bit of absolute magical chaos and whimsy, but like...
Well, I think we're so used to things just being regulated.
It's weird. Like, you could just set up a board key and travel inside of, like, a vault at Gringotts and just steal all the gold and then hop back out because you made up a portkey. Like, how hard is it to set up protective curses or magic?
I think a lot of the buildings and places are probably have protections.
I wonder how hard it is for a certain business or area to set up the required, like, magical protections to make sure no one can portkey in there, and if that would work similarly to setting up magical protection so you can't apparate in there. Because again, things like bank vaults or like people's personal homes where they have their own things.
Yeah, I feel like that must be common practice.
Yeah.
Like you just have some kind of security system. And I'm assuming most people have it so you can't just apparate into like their house or portkey into their house. You probably have like a flu or something, or they probably have it set up so like only certain people have access or whatever. Kind of like how like you have like the doors with the codes.
But that would mean it works like there's a wall around your house and people can't portkey or apparate through the wall, but they can inside, because we know people like the twins apparate from room to room. So like maybe you have a circle and like you can apparate inside it, but only from inside it. You can't transition from inside the circle to outside of the circle via portkey or apparation. And that's sort of what the protections would be.
Out of all the transportations we now know of or from the Wizarding World, what one do you think you would probably use the most, or what one would you not like want to use?
I love the idea of apparition. I think it's great. But as a person who can't drive,
yeah,
I feel like I also couldn't apparate. Like, I don't know. Part of me thinks that I can't drive because like steering and hand-eye coordination. And so if apparition is not at all like that, it is just based on like focus and like intent, I could apparate, and I think it would be one of my favorites. Assuming I could do it. The night bus would make me throw up.
Yeah.
I'm guaranteed. I think I would like flying. I don't know, but on a broom. Like, I can't imagine them being comfortable or, like, how I would hold on to it. Like, I've been on horses before. And you do have to do a bit of holding on with your legs and balancing and stuff. But a horse is wider and softer than a broom. So I don't think I would be comfortable with broom flying, just, like, from, like, a sitting around and traveling for a while perspective. But I think, like, visually, like, looking out at the sky and looking down at the city, I would love. So, like, flying via non-broom, like, whimsical animal travel or something, I think would be entirely my scene. I love the train, but it's not really magic, but I love the train.
Yeah.
I think, for convenience, apparition would be the best because it's quick and it's straight to the point. For enjoying the ride, trains or flying on, like, a hippogriff, I think, would be my favorite, just to like, especially at night, like to be flying in the sky at night.
I think I also lean toward apparition just because I feel like there's a lot of times in my real life where I just want to like have to go somewhere, and because I don't drive, it's a lot of like planning out transit routes. I'm like, I could just be there.
Very fair.
I feel like the portkey, when they were describing it, and I think it would make me motion sick as well as the night bus.
Yeah. I think I'd throw up.
I also consider flu, but that's also a lot of spitting, but I feel like it's more contained because portkeys, I don't know, it just feels, it doesn't feel as contained. So I think you can close your eyes with the flu and it's like you're going into a fireplace. It doesn't feel as crazy for some reason. It would definitely no to the night bus or brooms. I have a fear of heights. So any kind of flying, I don't think I would be into.
I would like the flying. I would just need to figure out how to make the broom option comfortable. Like put a chair on my broom.
But do you have any closing remarks for this chapter?
I feel like not a lot happened in this chapter. It's like, wake up, time to go, we're going. And it just feels so...
Yeah, it's very transitional.
I mean, it's necessary in the book because you have to get places. But it seems like there's a lot of transitional and like reminder chapters in the first part of this book, you know? It's like, okay, 3 chapters of Harry's a wizard and his aunt and uncle suck, and then we're walking.
Yeah, it's a weird transitional book too, because it's like still a kid's book technically, but it has like those chapters where it just like really short chapters just to tell you things that are going to be important later, but it's also still trying to be like this young adult book that's like telling a story about a lot of big things.
Yeah, it still kind of assumes the audience is very young.
It was trying to prepare people because this is the last book that's very much like children, I think, because Order of Phoenix just like opens right up to everything.
I kind of view this book like the Yule Ball is when they hit puberty. Like the introduction of the Yule Ball is a concept. It's a dance. That's when we get, oh, dating, and oh, who do you take to the dance? Like, that's when they transition into, like, sort of teenagers. That concept was there as, like, a baby step into that. So they're still children until the Yule Ball.
Yeah, that's just, we're transitioning from, like, you know, children into, like, as with the characters, into their teenhood. So, yeah, there's a lot of chapters that are kind of, like, could have been combined into other ones, but they're just transitioning us slowly into the narrative of this novel. So yeah, this chapter was just to kind of get us places, and we're reintroducing Cedric, and we're learning about Portkeys, which play a big part.
Yeah, like you were just wanting to get to the Burrow for so long, and they leave the Burrow so quickly, and it's like, okay, now get on to the next thing. Like, I feel like maybe it's our generation's short attention spans, but like, yeah, something should happen now, please and thank you.
I'm just waiting for action to happen.
Yeah, something bad is happening somewhere and we're not hearing about it, so.
Where's Voldemort? What's he doing? All right, well, thank you for listening to this episode of Potter Revisited, and we'll be back next time to discuss Chapter 7 of Goblet of Fire, Bagman, and Crouch. We finally get to meet Mr. Crouch. Percy's so hyped.
He is so hyped.
Yeah, but if you have any thoughts about this episode, you can email us at PotterRevisitedPodcast@gmail.com or on social media at PotterRevisited, and we will see you next time.
Bye.